Alti, the online portal for institutional investors in Germany, Austria and Switzerland.
In today's Alti interview, we have Jessica Eistrand and Ulf Erlandsson. Both come from Sweden. Mr. Erlandsson specializes in climate investments. He is working on a strategy called Diem Green Credit. Jessica helps implement alternative investment strategies for investors in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland. Jessica, you have been living with your family in Germany for a very long time. You know the needs and requirements of German-speaking professional investors. Please introduce yourself and explain to us why ESG is so important in the modern investment process.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting us to speak with you and for having us. I am Jessica Eistrand. I'm a business development strategist specializing in alternative investments. I worked in the industry mainly with institutional investors in the Nordics for more than 20 years now, helping them with allocations into international markets, with their alternative investment strategies, or in, with investment solutions such as ESG implementation or ETF implementation or climate change strategies. Mm-hmm. So when I look at the overall asset allocation policies of my clients over the past few years, it's clear to see that great strides have been made so far when it comes to ESG implementation on listed assets or public markets. And the bar has certainly been raised drastically when it comes to alternative assets and in the selection of alternative managers as well. So we have lots of data and tools and standards readily available for some parts of the market. But when it comes to fixed income markets and credit portfolios, there's only really been conversations around divestment or not, or green bonds or not. But then when I met with Ulf and learned about the work that he's been doing in terms of fixed income markets and credit spread analysis in context of carbon emission, I found that to be very innovative and inspiring, quite frankly. And when it comes to sustainable investing, you know, I'm looking to work with managers who can demonstrate that they worked with ESG incorporation and stewardship, obviously, and that they've consistently been doing so for the past few years. So I'm looking for managers who bring solutions and that can allow investors to address certain investment restrictions and limitations, not just only talking about it, but who can also show that they've been thinking about these things and actively finding solutions for it to help investors. And one of those fundamental expectations and limitations right now is with regards to climate change. It is by far the biggest issue my clients are concerned about.
Thank you. This brings us to Ulf Erlandsson. You have focused on climate investments. Please tell us about yourself and what drives you.
Hello, Ulf Erlandsson, I'm a father of three kids, 45 years old, and I'm currently the CIO of this DM Green Credit strategy. I used to work at one of the Swedish state pensions, AP4, and worked a lot with the sort of green bonds and that side of the investment dimension, and that has led me to this project where we're starting to launch this strategy within the climate field. Just as a side note, and we're not having this conversation in German, but I've actually spent quite a lot of time in German. I used to study in Freiburg once upon a time, so quite keen to get back and get to know the German audience a little bit better again.
So what ultimately led you to develop the Green Diem Credit strategy?
So really, what I've been doing over my career is looking at, I started out in investment banking and designing fairly quantitative credit trading and hedge fund strategies once upon a time. And then I left for this AP4 pension fund in Sweden and ran global credit there. And in that process, when I managed the portfolios there, and as I mentioned, we started trading a lot of green bonds. And green bonds was really a big sort of invite for myself on a personal level to get more involved in thinking around, you know, the climate challenge. And it was also actually back then when it started out, a great way to make money. And, you know, as my career has progressed, I've thought more and more about it. And, you know, the past 2 years, the intensification of the climate challenge and the discussion of that even in mainstream finance has also grown quite substantially. So that's been quite interesting to see.
Why is climate change and an appropriate response from investors so important for the capital investment?
I think, and I think I should say that I came from this from the beginning, almost from a quantitative standpoint. You started looking at things like, you know, carbon dioxide exposure in your portfolios, and you started doing some calculations around that. And pretty quickly, once you start doing it from the quantitative angle, you start also linking it up with, you know, if this is the carbon footprint of my portfolio, how much does that actually relate to, for example, the Swedish total domestic emissions of CO2, or this coal-financed or coal project in Australia, the emissions from that, how does that actually relate or in magnitude to what I have in my portfolio? And once you get to that level, even from the mathematical angle almost, you realize the challenges we have with regards to climate change and how much we actually need to adjust. And I think for me on a personal level, that was more a realization that, or somehow also a frustration that we need to do so much more than what's actually happening in a lot of parts of financial markets. A lot is happening today, more than 5-6 years ago, but still when it comes to fixed income markets, not nearly enough of what needs to be done is happening.
What are your recommendations to investors?
So there are a lot of things you can do. The obvious trade is always to try and sort of avoid the worst type of emitters. You look at sort of exclusion policies, etc., and then you try to switch in your long risk positions into greener type of assets. And I think a lot of people are already there. What we try to argue is some sort of ESG version 2.0 in some sense, where you start taking the long short dimension of this. So not only do you go long the good green assets, but you also look at opportunities to be short the brown bad assets that you, you know, think are sometimes not ecologically but also economically not sustainable. And you start looking at the trading opportunities from that side as well. And I think that's where, you know, my background as sort of a hedge fund strategist is can be to some help to people who are not used to look at it from the more long-short perspective.
Long green and short brown. That sounds really easy. What does reality say?
So being a, you know, credit guy, fixed income guy, being short is a difficult trade, but you can actually make it work. So there are two ways, really, I look for structuring this. Either you figure out where there are cheap shorts. So essentially, you structure your trades a little bit. So you get almost like optionality value on carbon risks happening. We've actually been running a model portfolio within my strategy where we've done these sort of cheap shorts on the fossil sector. And there has been some extremely positive developments of that side of the portfolio with the recent market volatility. So it's quite nice to see how our sort of short exposures there have actually worked when there's been this sort of big repricing on the back of oil. The second approach that you want to take, so you have the cheap shorts, but sometimes you also can take the more activist approach. And we argue that, you know, in some cases, the market has just, and especially large sort of institutional investors might have gone wrong and they own the wrong bonds, they own the wrong exposures. And the more they start committing to ESG and sustainability, the more vulnerable those positions are. So if we can find out where those positions are, you know, in certain issuers, and I can, you know, give you a little bit of an example of that later on, then you can actually push an activist short, as we call it, where you discuss the ecological issue, you discuss why people shouldn't be owning those bonds, and you start, you know, you put on a short position and you start pushing other people's positions out of that paper with the relevant price falls in it, where we sort of try to make, you know, the market reprice capital to the right level, and we make a profit for investors potentially as well.
Is the underlying liquidity of the markets a significant restriction for this strategy?
Liquidity is always a restriction for any strategy. When it comes to the activist side of things, where we actually look to be short in the cash market, it is an important part of what we do, and we will, you know, very specifically have people monitoring and working that, but it's not impossible. And especially, I think what's interesting here with a lot of the fossil risks, they are sitting in investment grade, where liquidity is better than in some of the high yield names, for example. You know, a company like, I mean, just exemplifying here, Royal Dutch Shell, they have a large capital structure. It's easier to source bond for borrow and for your short positions than if you're playing in a sort of a small high yield energy name.
Do you use options and derivatives to implement your strategy?
And we don't use options explicitly. Mm-hmm. We do use credit default swaps as another way to be outright short in credits. Okay. Sometimes we call this the cheap short trade. We actually call it carbon optionality trade, because what you can do, and this is slightly technical, but if you put on a curve trade in credit, you can sort of make it almost have like an option, like payoff structure, which can be interesting.
Does your strategy use leverage?
Yes, we are using leverage. We are intending to have a large, not a very big for a hedge fund perspective, but a decent sort of return target. And you know, for some of the trades we are doing, like the curve trades, it's a natural component that you use leverage. So there's going to be gross leverage, and there's going to be certain net leverage as well, in order to make it an interesting investment product as well. But you know, we can return to exact calculations of that. Again, I think we are much more focused on the large capital structures and investment grade. So it's not a question of going completely haywire in the likes of some of the stuff that happened back 10 years ago or 15 years ago.
The suspicion of greenwashing rises again and again. Transparency is probably the best solution to protect yourself from it. How do you deal with the transparency of your strategy?
So one thing that's important with what we do is that we try to have a little bit of a larger footprint than only, you know, the investments we make. And one way to do that is actually to be extremely transparent to our investors what we are invested in. So everyone can, you know, be able to access a lot of information around, you know, what the portfolio is and how we motivate each of those trades. We also use a system that I designed when I was at AP4 called Ecobar, which essentially is a quantitative framework to track all the positions in a more complex credit portfolio and, you know, score them in a way and score the portfolio so that, you know, we generate a number which relates to the sort of the greenness of the portfolio. But I completely and utterly agree on this, the greenwash dimension. I see a fair amount of that in the business, and transparency is essential to that. It doesn't mean that you sometimes cannot do, you know, controversial trades. I think we will probably be involved in things that people feel, is that super green or not? But we will always be open to discussing that, and we will, you know, have those engagement and conversations, especially with potential investors, because we think it's so important to develop this space.
How can the investor invest in your strategy?
So I'll say something in general, and I've actually written about this at the Responsible Investors webpage as well. Unfortunately, the UCITS format does not allow fiscal shorts, and that's based on sort of an extrapolation of the risks in fiscal shorts when it comes to the equity side.
Yeah.
And we will require to use fiscal shorts on bonds that we don't like in our strategy. So the UCITS format, unfortunately, looks like it's not going to be relevant for it for us. And then it's going to be more likely to put a strategy like this in some sort of ICAV, CCAV type of structure. But we haven't exactly nailed down everything in the structure, but that looks like the most likely solution.
For most capital market participants, it is important to meet climate goals. However, it is conceivable that, for example, situations arise in a larger company that conflict with this. Have you already experienced this, and how do you deal with it?
So I see a big discourse between what's happening often on the equity side and on the fixed income side. And then, you know, what I do is based on the fixed income side. And I could even give it like a almost live example of this. So back in mid-February, Siemens, they had their annual general meeting, if you remember, and you know, had Extinction Rebellion protesting outside.
Yep.
On the back of this whole Adani story, where Siemens is providing rail signaling systems to Adani. Adani is actually building one of the greatest coal mines in human history, and that's pretty controversial, to say the least.
Yep.
But even more interesting than the Extinction Rebellion there, we actually had one of the world's largest asset managers on the inside, actually one of the biggest shareholders in the company as well, and also protesting against the contracts with Adani. And that was, I think, like a $35 million contract or something like that. So not a massive one, but really one that, you know, stirred some emotions. And I actually think that the asset manager was quite right in order to criticizing Siemens for this, to be clear. But on the same day, and this is where I see this as a portfolio manager in fixed income, one of the subsidiaries of Adani, an electricity generator, actually, which has lots of coal generation capacities. You can imagine what the coal they're building in Australia, where that's actually going to go. They're out in the global bond markets. They put out a BBB rated dollar issue, $1 billion with a 5x oversubscribed book. So orders for more than $5 billion for, you know, taking risk in this coal generation company. And now, going back, and you can just look it up on your Bloomberg terminal even, you can see that, you know, the same guys who on the equity side were very active with regards to criticizing Siemens, they were actually the biggest investors in the bonds of the Adani subsidiary. And I just find that, you know, intellectually inconsistent from a personal level, but I also think there's a big discrepancy between what's going on in equities and what's happening in fixed income. It's like, you know, fixed income is the forgotten cousin from the countryside who no one really tends to with the same attention. Yeah. And I find that you know, a great opportunity for the strategy, but then I find it also very depressing from more of a, you know, father of three perspective, that the markets haven't come further than this.
Finally, please give us an assessment of the current situation with the volatilities triggered by the coronavirus on the market.
Yes, definitely. And I think actually one should say here, there are two, and there's a combination of effects with regards to the coronavirus, but also what we saw when this corona crisis intensified. We also had this big OPEC output glut type of operation. We viewed, and looking at the model portfolio we run, it has quite a short exposure to a lot of the fossil energy producers. And some of the moves that we saw in bonds on the long-dated fossil side were outsized, if we put it that way, on Monday the 9th, when really market volatility increased exponentially. You'd see long-dated Exxon bond, for example, fell by, you know, 10-12 percentage points, and then that's just an outright price and not even versus benchmark versus governments. So some extremely large losses with regards to the energy exposure. And I think funds that have been exposed to high yield energy in the US have done extremely poorly in this stage. And I think that sort of shows the guide for the future. You will not own an oil asset again and consider it with the same sort of underlying volatility as we have done historically, because we are actually right now seeing a repricing of some of these risks. And this is a combination of factors of what happened with OPEC as well as the coronavirus. So it's not, might not be the coronavirus explicitly. Another thing we have also seen in the model portfolio is that we had short exposures also to some airline companies. And it's very obvious how the transportation sector is going to be affected. And, you know, the combination here of the long distance type of transportation, which is very fossil dependent, and the relationship to what happens in sort of the long distance travel business over the foreseeable future is going to be quite related. So I think there is the coronavirus in itself might not be an extreme theme, but with combination of other factors, what we're seeing right now is a big upheaval in the sort of green and climate themes.
Many thanks to Ulf Erlandsen for these illuminating impressions about ESG investments and the presentation of the strategy he is working on. Thanks also to Jessica Astrand, who will be happy to answer any questions afterwards.
ALTI, the online portal for institutional investors in Germany, Austria and Switzerland. ALTI.com. ALTI.com.